So back in 1987, when I was just a kid, I started as a journalist at the age of 10. Back in 1987, I was approached by a husband and wife who live on Maryland's Eastern Shore. And they wanted me to look at their case, at their story. Now, this is something that happens a lot. And by 1987, I had a pretty well-established reputation as an investigative reporter. We had done some pretty heavy-duty work in the couple of years prior to that that got a lot of attention. And so when they approached me to look at their story, it was not unusual to be approached kind of, it's like a cold call. Their last name was Bloodsworth. Their son is Kirk Bloodsworth. Ring a bell? So what they wanted me to look at was the case of the state of Maryland versus Kirk Bloodsworth. And my answer to them was, wow. Because the state of Maryland versus Kirk Bloodsworth was a death penalty case. And Kirk, by 1987, had been twice convicted for the sex murder of a 9-year-old girl in Baltimore County. It was a high-profile case. Everybody knew about it. Everybody had scared everybody to death when it happened because it was a stranger-on-stranger crime. The little girl was brutalized. Her body was found in the woods. There was a massive police hunt and police investigation, and it all settled on Kirk Bloodsworth. He was arrested. He was prosecuted. He was convicted. He was sentenced to die. That conviction was overturned due to an error by the prosecution. He was tried again. He was convicted again. And the second time around, he was sentenced to life. And one of the reasons he was sentenced to life is something that we found when we said to Curtis Bloodsworth and his wife, okay, we'll take a look. They were convinced that their son was innocent. They thought he had been wrongfully charged, wrongfully prosecuted, and wrongfully sentenced to die. So they turned over to us an enormous box of material. It was the material that was used in the defense of their son, and it included a lot of information that we were able to develop from what we were given. We started over a period of 4 months to really look at this case. It's probably one of the riskiest things I've ever done as a journalist, because the risk for us was that we would look to be taking the side of a twice convicted child killer, a man who had served time on death row. What if we're wrong? In many ways, I felt like we were putting our reputation on the line when we decided to go forward with a story of what we found. And here's what we found. First of all, police made a terrible mistake. They failed to preserve the most important physical evidence that they collected at the time of the crime. They literally took the swabs of the body fluid prepared by the medical examiner, stuck them in their coat pocket, and forgot about them. They were destroyed. They failed to follow up on really important information, crucial information, about another potential suspect. That other potential suspect came to light in 1987 in what I can only describe as one of those Perry Mason moments when he was brought into court at Kirk Bloodsworth's second sentencing. The whole courtroom gasped because he looked so much like the composite in the case. He then was put on the stand and took the fifth and refused to answer any questions about his activities on the day of the crime, which were highly suspicious. We put together an investigative piece that was about 12 minutes long that aired in 1988. We called it A Question of Justice. We were trying to be very careful. We raised the questions of the mistakes that police made in the investigation, the massive police investigation that overlooked information and evidence They were so desperate to try to focus on a suspect and get someone locked up. The piece aired, and following the piece, people started raising questions. Baltimore County, as you know, was kind of the death penalty capital of the state. Most death penalty cases came out of Baltimore County. I later learned that the Public Defender's Office, because of the story that we had done and the questions that we had raised about the integrity of the prosecution, the veracity of the prosecution, and the competence, literally the competence of the police investigation, because of the questions that we had raised, they elected to go to an outside attorney who was a specialist in capital cases and retain him because they believed that Kirk Bloodsworth was an innocent man. I met Kirk in 1987, and from that moment on, I became one of his pen pals, so to speak, while he was in prison and I was working on his story and the follow-ups after the story aired. I have an entire file full of his letters. Each one of them is signed an innocent man. In 1993, Kirk's lawyer, his new lawyer, was able to get the state's attorney's office in Baltimore County to turn over some of the evidence in the case for testing. You probably know what kind of testing we're talking about, DNA testing. DNA wasn't available at the time Kirk was initially prosecuted in 1984 and again in 1987. But it became available towards the end of the 1980s and early 1990s. And no one knew more about it than Kirk Bloodsworth. Letter after letter after letter that he wrote, he would talk about wanting to have his case subject to DNA testing. So I kind of think you know the story of what happened, at least the news side of it. The news side of it is that they found a piece of evidence. It happened to be the little girl's underwear that were hanging in a tree at the crime scene. And they found a little spot of semen. This was a sex crime. They found a little spot of semen on the underwear. And because of the new technology of DNA testing, the testing, in fact, came back, and it wasn't Kirk's DNA. In June of 1993, Kirk Bloodsworth was released from prison. That day, Sandra O'Connor, the state's attorney in Baltimore County, said, well, he's not guilty, but he's not innocent. He went on to try to rebuild his life. 10 years later, in 2003, a police technician pulled off the shelf some of the evidence that still remained from the murder of the little girl and now used even better sophisticated DNA testing. And sure enough, it got a hit. It matched someone who was already in prison in Maryland for a sex crime. It matched him. That man was arrested. That man pleaded guilty to the murder of the little girl. 10 years after that, 2013, last year, the Maryland legislature repealed the death penalty. No one was more important to that legislation, no one was more important to the repeal of that law than Kirk Bloodsworth. Kirk has been an advocate. He's traveled the world to tell his story. People ask me all the time, what's the most important story you've ever done? And there are many of them. I talk about Kirk Bloodsworth as the most enduring story I've ever done. It is a story that has covered most of my career. I covered the crime in 1984. It was horrible. Parents were in a panic. You can imagine. Little girl looking for her lost cousin. Some man comes up, leads her off. The next thing you know, her body's found. She's been sexually abused. Horrible case. And nobody knows who did it. The region was in a panic. When I investigated the case, the prosecution of Kirk Bloodsworth. It raised some of the most troubling questions I've ever struggled with. Because at the time, Maryland wasn't one of the most active death penalty states in the country, but it had it, and it was executing people. In most states, in many states, Kirk Bloodsworth would be dead. No question about it. And the question that we raised was, if we're going to have capital punishment, don't we have to be perfect? The prosecutor who prosecuted Kirk in the very lengthy first piece that we did said in the interview and in the piece that aired, "I'm not saying that mistakes weren't made. I'm saying there's no mistake about who did this." That was in 1988. So when people ask me, what's the most important story you've ever done? I say, well, this is the most enduring. And there's two things about this story that, for as long as I live, I will never forget. One was, actually three. The first was in the spring of 1993 when I knew, because I was in touch with Kirk the entire time he was in prison, I knew that the evidence had been turned over for DNA testing. I knew that it was being shipped to a lab in California, a private lab. I knew that whatever that lab found would be confirmed by the FBI. And I also knew that there was a letter from the state's attorney's office in Baltimore County that said, if the DNA comes back, and if it doesn't match Kirk Bloodsworth's DNA, we will release him. But what's the flip side of that story? What if it does match? So I had this conversation with Kirk as the testing was being done and we didn't know the results yet. And I said, you know, this is kind of truth or dare time. Because what if it comes back and you're in the group? And his answer was, that won't happen. In 2003, when the real suspect was arrested, identified through DNA testing, arrested, the day of his arrest, he was already in prison, so he didn't have to be arrested, he was charged. The director of communications for the Baltimore County Police Department called me and said, you're probably the second most relieved person on the face of the earth. He said that because he knew that we had put our neck on the line in 1988 when we did that very lengthy story and devoted so much time to the Kirk Bloodsworth case. The Baltimore County State's Attorney's Office barely spoke to us. We had a lot of trouble with the police department because our story was highly critical of both. Because this was the ultimate case. This was a case of capital punishment. So the test came back in May of 1993. And as long as I live, I'll never forget the phone call I got on that afternoon from Jessup. On the other end of the line, have you ever gotten a call from prison? It's always, we have a collect call from the, you know, Maryland Correctional Institute. So there was the recording, and I accepted the call, and all I could hear on the other end of the line was sobbing. And he finally managed to say, it's not me. If you've ever wondered what freedom sounds like, it was on the other end of the phone that day. And as long as I live, I will never forget how it took my breath away to hear a man who had been condemned to die, who had spent 9 years from the age of 23 to 32 on death row and in prison, who thought he would never see the light of day again, who maintained his innocence steadfastly, and he was proven right. What was on the other end of that phone that day was pure 100% joy. Thank you very much.